special present for you, a Thursday edition of the CBSSports.com College Hoops podcast. And I don't know, maybe I'm making this a tradition because I had this fella on last year during the tournament. Actually, I think leading up to the Sweet 16. But so much has happened since then, and it's been great to see Tim Burke of now Deadspin.com, among other things. I mean, you still have your hat in so many things, you know, in running Mock Session and all that good stuff. Hey, it's great to have you back on, man, and it's I'm also humbled that despite your repeated appearances on television with Olbermann, you're still willing to come on this dinky little podcast, so I appreciate that.
Oh, it's always nice to talk to you, Matt.
You see, I'm used to so much more braggadocio from Parrish and Goodman. You're quaintly humble, and I appreciate that, but it's throwing me off my game. So how are things, man? I mean, I guess I should let the audience know that, you know, the primary reason I'm having you on is because your alma mater made it to the Sweet 16. So how has Ohio been changing your life over the past, and maybe even beyond a week, when you knew that they had a chance to get there with, even though they weren't the best team in the MAC, kind of winning that conference tournament, and you getting that source, you know, sense of pride? Because when people go to big-time schools like Carolina, Kentucky, Ohio State, even Baylor, which is on the come in the past few years, it's always rewarding, but it's so different when you have a smaller school not only get to the tournament, not only win one game, but you have the rare opportunity to cheer on your boys making it to the second weekend.
It's difficult sometimes to put it into a context, Matt, because, you know, we both, you know, we're in journalism. A lot of the people we work with or our colleagues attended, say, Northwestern. I mean, my boss, Tommy Craggs, went to Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And this is a school that has never even been to the NCAA tournament. And so, you know, for me to say, well, we're going to the Sweet 16, and, you know, yes, we've been there before. It was before I was born. It was in 1964, the last time that Ohio was in the round of 16. It's like, what am I supposed to feel? It's a little strange. And so a lot of it I've been trying to sort of, my kid brother graduated 4 years after I did from Ohio. And a lot of my lens through which I've viewed what's happening is through, you know, me helping him, you know, get a ticket to the game on Friday and having a chance to, you know, experience everything for himself, since, you know, I'm working and won't be able to go myself. I've always sort of been a little more, I guess, rabid a Bobcat fan than certainly the people around me here in Florida that I see. Being able to hang the flag up outside my house every day, it's really difficult when you're in a place where you've never been before. And I kind of it really, in the last couple moments, especially I think of the Michigan game, the USF game was a little weird. It wasn't as, you know, you saw the Michigan game. It was a beautiful,
awesome
basketball
game.
It was, you know, when you talk about basketball and the flow of the game and how you can sometimes compare it to soccer when both teams are playing well on offense, but they're playing even better defense. That was that game. And even though USF Ohio was also a very competitive game down to the last minutes, it wasn't a beautiful game. Mm-hmm. And it was especially tough for me too, because, you know, I did my PhD work at USF, and, you know, when I first, you know, started following the Bulls, it was, you know, when they were first joining Conference USA. So I've been with USF through all of that evolution, all of those changes, and that team means a lot to me as well. I had to pick sides, and obviously I'm going to pick the one that, you know, the school I attended first and the school that, you know, is my bachelor's degree. But there were still, I wasn't able, I think, to really sort of envelop myself in it enough to feel that moment. But that Michigan game, there's the metaphor that, you know, they say the taste, you know, you can taste victory, and it's not really a metaphor. The feeling of an unexpected win and all that goes along with it really is it's a true sense. And believe it or not, the first time I felt that sense was in 2005, also in Nashville, when the Bobcats were tied with 45 seconds left against Florida in the first round game, that they ended up losing 62-60. But that sensation of being able to taste victory is so unique and so strange. You know, some people may be unfortunate enough never to actually, you know, have that sensation. But you have that sensation, and it's something that you sort of carry with you for the rest of your life. And I think beating Michigan was that way. And that's, I guess, how I can sort of describe it, is that it's a sensation that sort of fills your body, and you want to continue bringing it with you. But just like the flavor of a good meal that you had the night before, you know, the memories are never so strong as the actual sensation in the moment.
A few things on Ohio. One, I feel they're one more year away from getting another big win, not necessarily even making the second weekend, although that really has a lot of impact. But they're one more year of doing this and then becoming kind of nationally recognized, not as much as Butler or VCU or Gonzaga, but, you know, Ohio, they just mollywopped Georgetown 2 years ago. In that game that some people have already forgotten about. But now you make a Sweet 16, and then if they do it again, people will have a frame of reference. And it's also good for Ohio that they made the second weekend, because while you and I and plenty of people were into that Ohio game, it was happening at the same time as Lehigh-Duke. And so Lehigh just totally overshadowed what Ohio had done. And so now the Bobcats kind of get their moment here as they play Friday night. So... No, hey, it's fantastic, man, and at least I always love when we can get a non-BCS team, the double-digit seed, into the second weekend. It just gives it that little bit of flavor. It's that paprika in the bracket, so to speak, that just gives a little more spice. And yeah, they don't have a great chance to beat Carolina, but at least they're in the game, and the lead-up to it and the build-up is fun. And if they're losing by 17 with 10 to go, then, you know, it was what it was, but it's ultimately, it's a net win for the program. I mean... Goodness, I'm not sure how much money Ohio's made off of this, but trust me, it's thousands upon thousands of dollars.
Well, Matt, it's sort of one of the unique, I don't want to say ironies or contradictions of the way that the bracketing system works, that the Bobcats' chance of making the Sweet 16 was really somewhat contingent upon them being that 13 seed.
Right.
That you know, next year with all the players on the team back, say they win the MAC again and they go, I don't know, 25-3 in the regular season or something, and they end up with, you know, an 8 or a 9 seed. Well, suddenly you face a much larger obstacle to making the second weekend, and so you really to some degree, and it worked out this way. I think obviously they ran into Tennessee 2 years ago, and that knocked them out. But you know, being able to face a team that they could exploit the mismatches, and obviously, you know, what happened 2 years ago with Georgetown is kind of an anomaly. But to some degree, I think that upsets happen because of the seeding system being more, it provides a greater privilege to teams that, you know, have that 12, 13, or even perhaps 14 than they would be if they were, you know, say a 7 or a 6 certainly an 8 or a 9, and the Bobcats drew the best possible draw that they could have for this tournament. Whether or not they played Temple or USF in that second round game, they had a certain chance, and nearly anywhere else in the bracket, had they been slotted there, they would have run into considerably more difficulty, I think.
I have not mentioned your Twitter handle yet, which, you know, obviously most that came to this podcast came via Twitter or just a general link on the site or whatnot. It's run down there. But you're Bubba Prague on Twitter, and we went over last year's podcast about, what was it? You're not a redneck Dream Theater fan or whatever you told me. Anyway, you've you know, kind of made your brand off of instant screen caps and GIFs and video, and landed a seat at the Deadspin table, man. That is fantastic. Do you want to tell listeners, I guess, how you got to that point and what the job's been like, and I guess all things related to it? Because this is you kind of hold a pretty coveted spot out there on the internet. There are plenty of people that would love to get a chance to write for Deadspin, particularly under Crags now, and you were able to wrangle that.
It wasn't that wild, Matt. The last time when we were here a year ago talking, I was a college professor who had a sort of, you know, amateur little website, and I tweeted out links to things, and I really did, not that this was a grand plan or that I really knew what I was doing, but I think I found upon something that really works well with the Twitter medium. That
well, you know, is putting it lightly. Okay. Yeah. It is the jelly to the peanut butter of Twitter, let's be real.
Okay, if you want to put it that way. And you know, I was looking, I think, after 10 years in academia to sort of find a way out, and I got that opportunity over the summer with Dan Abrams' sports site Sports Grid, and I worked a couple months for them. But even long before this, Craigs had been, you know, sort of talking to me about what I might be able to add to Deadspin, and, you know, especially focusing on bringing a multimedia approach, as well as, you know, doing some media criticism for the site. And I finally jumped at that opportunity in October and started in late October with Deadspin. And we've had quite a few pretty big, interesting things happen since I came on board, and things have been going really well. It is sometimes overwhelming, you know, when you think about when you publish on a site of the size of Deadspin, exactly how many people might read what you write. Mm-hmm. And you sort of compare that to, we overemphasize the power of TV sometimes, especially cable TV, and you know, that the number of people who might read something we write on Deadspin is the same number or more as might watch any, you know, news program on cable at any, you know, sort of random chosen hour. And that puts a lot of weight on you to sort of craft exactly how you're going to. I mean, television is this medium where you put something out there and it's done. Obviously, people can come back to it in the hypermedia age. Everything that goes on TV is then reformulated and repackaged for the internet. But with what we're doing, there's so many different sort of angles that you have to present. It's not just in the content that you write. It's also in how do we craft, you know, the tweet from the Twitter account to make it sound more interesting and attract people, not just to click the link, but to also share it. And the same thing happens with Facebook. Now, I'm obviously a little more Twitter oriented, and I don't know if that's because of an attention span issue or what, but you know, the way that Facebook sharing and the likes and all that stuff happens, I'm a little less familiar with that, or maybe I just don't care to be as integrated with it as I am with Twitter. But you know, we've developed some tools, and we're really trying to build the way that people not only want to read what we're producing, but also want to show other people that they're reading it and that it's something that they might be interested in, while still maintaining sort of the Deadspin attitude and the sort of content that we have become known for featuring on our site.
No, I mean, listen, with the hires Craigs has made, you know, obviously, you know, you, Luke O'Brien, Eric, although I think Luke came on before Craigs was officially in charge, but just the look of the site and the tone of it and the direction has evolved, I think is the proper term, and it's been good. Now, in terms of you, is March the busiest year? Let's get into what you do, because many people listening to this podcast certainly follow you on Twitter, and they see how you're just so at the ready with this kind of instant reaction. And specifically during this past weekend, and even now, Sweet 16, when it's going to be tough for a lot of people to keep an eye on two games simultaneously. One, is this the busiest year? And can you give us, I don't know, just tell us what it's like to be, if we were to sit silently next to you while you do your thing, what's your setup? You know, I think I asked you last year what your cable bill was, and you said, like, I don't know, $300 or something like that. I can't remember. But what, like, just let us know what it's like to do this and keep your wits about you, by the way. I'm not quite sure how you're able to really steer seven ships at once, which is certainly what you're doing sometimes.
I can't say that it's the busiest, but that's to some degree because the way that the NCAA tournament is organized, with it being on one broadcast network and three cable channels, is I built the groundwork of the current video setup that I have before last year's tournament when they introduced that broadcast format. So it's pretty easy for me to keep track of everything because I've got, you know, these separate cable tuners and their separate monitors sitting in front of me. And then I've got a broadcast monitor and then, you know, the computer monitor. So I've got four screens right in front of me. And during the NCAA tournament's first two main days, I've got the four games going on right there. And so it's really pretty easy for me to keep track of what's going on alongside the Twitter search algorithms that we've built to keep an eye on anything that we might be missing. I'd say that in terms of stress or in terms of craziness, I think a college football Saturday is a little more on that side, because there's only there's 16 games a day right on the Thursday and Friday of the tournament, whereas on a college football Saturday there's closer to 50. Mm-hmm. And so college football Saturdays, of which there are, 14 or 15, those are the real stress times of the year, because I'm trying to keep an eye on way more things. But for the NCAA tournament, I feel like I'm in a really comfortable place, and I can sort of stare forward, watch what's happening. But with the growth, I mean, that's the thing, man. A year ago, Twitter, while it had sort of come into its own by that point, there weren't so many people that were sort of must follows on Twitter a year ago as there are now. And what happens is when you have more people that you're following, Twitter is scrolling by faster.
Yes.
Which means you have to look at it more. And when you're looking at Twitter, what aren't you looking at?
Your TV, your computer.
You're not watching
your six computer screens.
You're not watching basketball.
Right.
So there's always this trade-off. And especially for me in the games that I really cared about, the Ohio games, right? Any time that I was trying to do work, write up a story, put up a video of something, you know, that's time taking me away from the screens. And, you know, once I get sort of locked into saying, okay, I'm going to have TBS on this monitor and TNT on this monitor and True TV on that monitor, you know, I can't really change it mid-game because the nature of my setup, which sometimes means that I do something foolish and have a screen that I'm working on all the way to the left while the game that I want to watch is all the way to the right. And, you know, that's where the complicated audio setup comes into play, where I have to, you know, switch what my speakers are playing back rather than what I'm actually watching on the monitor. So to be here with me while I'm working on the NCAA tournament is it's very stressful for anyone who has to watch, which is why my girlfriend refuses to be around me during those days. Oh, yeah. She stays entirely out of the house because it's just it's a mad place. And
well,
and
yeah,
I'm yelling and
you lead into what I was just gonna ask. Like, I know you got the lady in your life, and so she just gets it, right? She's just like, all right. Like, where does she go? Where does she go? Like, I mean, obviously maybe she has work sometimes, but like
she lives in Gainesville and I live in Jacksonville, and there's about an hour and a half between. So,
okay.
You know, we plan the times that we can be together. She's not a huge basketball person. She's a big college baseball fan and a big Major League Baseball fan and a huge Florida Gator football fan. But basketball has never really been her thing, even in the years that Florida, you know, was winning the national championship. And she's starting to sort of come around in basketball, and she understands why it's important that Ohio is in the Sweet 16 and why the state of Ohio is so big about having four teams in the Sweet 16.
Yeah,
she gets that. And, you know, she understands. It's always I'm very fortunate to have someone as understanding as her to sort of put up with this. And especially, and frankly, to put up with the mess of wires and cables that are in my living room at all times.
Yeah.
And while, you know, I'm in the works of putting together version 2.0 of this video setup, you know, we're also buying a house, and I have to think, how is this setup going to work in, you know, my new office that we build at the house? And, you know, it's always kind of a trade off. This is not the most pleasant place to be if you're not someone who is comfortable with clutter, we might say.
Yeah, I'm sure you've got an organized mess of wires that would make Tarzan drool. How about this? Where do you think we're going with the experience of watching the tournament, but sports in general, you know, next 3, 5, 7 years? Like, I almost feel like in 5 years, maybe 7 years, we're going to be watching most of this stuff on our computers with touch screens. And you're going to, like, I envision us watching the tournament, you know, lower right hand of your screen where you would have your GChat mod or whatever. You're going to have a selective Twitter feed that you choose for people that you want to follow during a game experience. You're going to be able to touch your screen and pause a game. And if you want to, like, and then if you're blasting out a GIF from something else, you'll be able to just simply touch the screen, bring up the GIF in, like, a separate, like, tinier window. I just feel like, for good or for bad, by the way, because there's something to be said about turning off the computer, turning off the devices, and watching an awesome game with five buddies in your living room. You know, like, that can be really, really great. But I still feel like the sports experience of watching things is becoming isolated, ironically, by bringing in many social media aspects, but still it's just you staring at a screen. Do you think that we are headed toward something similar to what I just described, or do you have a different envisionment of what's to come by 2017, 2018?
I think we're moving in that direction, but I mean, man, there was nothing I loved more than taking, you know, my paper bracket out to the bar on Thursday and
hanging out
there for 8 hours. You know, we used to talk about how we'd go to BW3s and we'd be there so long we had to eat twice. Yeah. And you know, Paul Pabst from the Dan Patrick Show mentioned something about how he was at a place so long he had to eat three times. He had to eat three meals. And it's like that experience and the sort of joy of that moment of experiencing such on a large scale with other people, I don't think that's ever going to go away. But you're right that the integration aspect of it is something that it's an unstoppable train because it does add so much to the experience. But there is a large group of people who don't get that, and I don't think ever will. They don't understand, you know, it's like that for any of us who enjoy watching. It doesn't have to be sports. It can be a TV program that enjoy watching them with people online. And there's a couple media theorists who have sort of written about this, that, you know, there are certain programs that have developed this online following of people who like the instant reactions that you can give on Twitter, but you can't give in person. For sports, if you talk over what's happening, you're not really missing anything. As wonderful as some of the broadcasters that are out there, you're not really missing anything. But if you're watching, say, Mad Men or The Walking Dead or Justified or any of these other sort of programs that are very social in nature, if you're talking, if you're watching with other people and you're actually talking, you're missing things. But where can you talk without missing anything? Well, you can tweet or you can talk on Facebook. So I think that a lot of that is going to continue to grow, but there's still going to be groups of people who don't really get it. And want to, you know, they want to stay focused in on the game. They don't like distractions. A lot of these are people who, you know, are very, you know, I don't want to pick on Kentucky fans or Florida fans, but they're very uninterested in any other teams but their own. And that's just sort of the nature of where they are. And so those people aren't necessarily going to buy into that idea. They want to watch their game. They don't want any interruptions or distractions. But I've sort of been pitching this idea to a lot of, you know, television executives that there is room for, I think, the way that they integrate Twitter and other social media in the broadcast themselves is really, I don't think they do a very good job of it. I think that the Turner aspect that they've added to the broadcast this year have done a better job because Turner's really good with the studio commentary experience. The Inside the NBA has obviously been a very successful program. They brought a lot of that over to the NCAA broadcast this season. And the way that they, I think, curate tweets that they present on screen, they do a pretty good job of that. But they're still full screening it. They're making a production of, hey, we're featuring someone's tweet right now. And I think that in the future, you're going to see a lot more, you know, I don't know if you remember the VH1, and maybe it's still on. I haven't watched VH1 in 10 years, but pop-up video.
Who doesn't know pop-up video, okay, my friend?
I think that you're going to see more pop-up video style tweets integrated with our sports coverage. And it's going to absolutely infuriate people who are like, oh, get that crap off the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, Matt, man, the technology is already there, you know, for separate data channels on our screens. I mean, there's so what you see in an HD video feed is only part of the data that comes through in that stream. And even, you know, basic televisions are entirely capable of printing out in fancy colors and fonts and everything else, things on any part of the screen. All of that data usage has been pretty much ignored by broadcasters. And I think it's probably because people don't want to figure out how to set up their TVs to deal with it. Mm. But I think that there's a great deal of untapped technology there for these sorts of things to happen, where you can watch the game and you can have curated, meaningful, funny, whatever social media interaction happening on the screen with you. Now, if in Google's world, you'll be interacting with it. Like, Google wants your television to be there and all your Google apps to be alongside with it. I think that's maybe a little too complicated for some people, and especially they don't want to have to hold a TV remote that has a full keyboard on it. But I think that people being able to either their own Twitter feeds or ones that are curated by the networks, I think that's sort of the future. I think people getting away from the computer, but still being able, not having to take their eyes off the screen and miss anything, but still be able to sort of follow what's happening. I think that's probably the future.
You know, what I love is plenty of people, and to everyone that's listening to the podcast, thank you for continued listening. They had no idea what they were in store for on this kind of surprise edition here. I'm like, listen, I'm like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And people are like, why aren't you talking about Baylor? You know what? Because we don't need to talk about Baylor, because by the time, you know, Baylor plays, that could be a little obsolete there. But hey, Tim Burke, at Bubba Prog on Twitter, as BUBBAPROG. And if you want any sort of, you know, good eye candy for web, you know, instant reaction, he's there. And also, by the way, a really good writer. And let's start seeing more out of that from you, man. Can we do that?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm working on it. I'm getting, as we get toward the baseball season and things get a little more relaxed, I'll have more time for writing.
Great stuff. Big things happening for you in your life, man. Continued congrats and success on that. And it was a pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
No problem. Okay, I am working diligently to get Clark Kellogg on Friday's podcast. I'm hoping that I can make this happen for you. Obviously, Clark's son plays for Ohio, and Ohio plays Friday night, so I'd love to get him on prior to that. So, efforting that, and then Steve Kerr maybe for Monday, but we'll see what we can arrange. Regardless, there will be pods, so thank you so much again for listening. We'll talk to you soon.